Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Search for Major Plaga, The Nazi Who Saved Jews, by Michael Good, narrated by James Romick. Publisher's Note: This audiobook may refer to visual elements included in the print and e-book editions of the book. I believe that the time has come for all right-minded, well-disposed people to extend their hands to each other across national boundaries to form a community of the solitary among the nations. For whoever seeks truth and justice nowadays remains solitary in the midst of a blind multitude crying for power and violence. Karl Plaga. Preface to the Second Edition. More than 7 years have passed since I first traveled to Vilnius, Lithuania, during the summer of 1999, and began what would be a life-changing journey in search of the mysterious German officer who saved my mother's life. During these years of exploration, as I tried to uncover the motivations and deeds of Karl Plaga, I have often wondered how many of the Jews and Germans whose lives intersected at the HKP workshops in Vilna between 1941 and 1944 have still remained hidden from history's view. Since the publication of the first edition of this book, I have had the opportunity to hear from new groups of HKP survivors and also from a German veteran of Plaga's unit, a man who had not talked about his wartime experiences outside of the family for more than 60 years. I am very happy to be able to share their remarkable stories in this new edition. Reading through the first 7 chapters of The Search for Major Plaga in the first edition, one cannot help but wonder about the role of the men of Plaga's unit in the unusual events that transpired under the guise of repairing Wehrmacht vehicles in Vilna, Poland, during World War II. There were more than 250 officers and enlisted men in this unit, HKP 562, and it is clear from the testimony of Plaga's subordinates at his 1947 denazification trial that some of the officers knew that many of the Jews employed in their workshops were not the essential skilled workers that Plaga had certified them to be. How many men within the unit understood that their commander was trying to thwart the efforts of the SS and save Jewish enemies of the state? Given the widespread anti-Semitism in Germany and the large measure of popular support enjoyed by the Nazi regime during the 1930s and early 1940s, one naturally wonders why Plaga was not denounced. With the discovery of Alphonse von Deschwanden, a veteran of Plaga's unit, who spent 3 years in the HKP workshops in Vilna from July 1941 until the German retreat in July 1944, we have been given the opportunity to see the world through the eyes of a young German draftee thrust into the midst of the Holocaust in Vilna. Due to the willingness of this aging veteran to break years of silence, and with the help of his daughter who translated my inquiries, we were able to explore a myriad of fascinating questions. What did an average Wehrmacht soldier understand about the genocide being carried out in Vilna? When did he discover the murderous nature of the Nazi regime? What did he understand about his commander's attitudes toward the Jewish slave laborers? What moral dilemmas did he personally face? With this new testimony, we are able to view the Holocaust in Vilna through the eyes of a German soldier and ponder in more detail what actions were possible in resisting the madness that prevailed during those terrible years. Throughout the course of my original search, I interviewed more than a dozen Jewish HKP survivors. However, there were undoubtedly more whom I had yet to encounter. After Vilna was liberated by the Red Army on July 13, 1944, the HKP survivors scattered across the globe. Most of the camp's surviving children remained unidentified over the decades that followed. What details and stories did they have to tell that would help us understand the life-saving events that led to their miraculous survival? Over the past 2 years, I have had the good fortune to meet several new HKP survivors, and with the publication of this second edition, I am able to share new material that has come to light. These new stories, like those of my original search, will, I hope, allow one to once again ponder humanity's dual nature, our propensity to act violently out of fear and bigotry, juxtaposed against our often unexpected capacity for acting with nobility and moral courage. It is this dual nature of man that I hope many will continue to think about. Perhaps these stories of good and evil from Vilna will help illuminate for future generations the path that leads away from the horrors of war and genocide and toward that better side of human nature, which we must all struggle to reveal within ourselves. Michael Good, July 2006. Part 1. An American Awakening. Introduction. On a warm spring day in June of 1999, I stood in the courtyard of the Harris Kraftfahrpark, HKP, labor camp, in Vilnius, Lithuania, military vehicle repair park in English. Flanking the courtyard were tall buildings that had once housed over 1,000 Jewish workers and their families, all slave laborers for the German war effort. I listened as my mother told me the story of how she and her parents had survived the Holocaust, unlike so many other members of our family. She explained that her survival was largely due to the efforts of the German army officer in charge of the HKP camp, a certain Major Plaga. "He was better than Schindler," she exclaimed as she told how Major Plaga had protected his prisoners from the murderous intent of the SS. I had traveled to Lithuania with my parents, wife, and teenage children to see our city of origin, to hear of all those who were lost during the war, and to retrace my parents' tales of survival during the Holocaust. As I pondered the miracle of my family's existence, I asked my mother what had become of this German major. "No one knows," she replied. "Plaga had left Vilna with the retreating Germans in July 1944, and vanished into the chaos of the final months of the war. No one had heard of him since. The toponymy of Vilna is very complex given the number of times the city has been controlled by different nations. Thus, it is called Vilnius by the Lithuanians who live there today. For the Poles, it was Vilno, and the Germans called it Vilna. The Russians and Jews called it Vilna. Different ethnic groups within the city refer to it by different names. Following the usage of my parents, I will call it Vilna when referring to the city they grew up in before and during the war, but will refer to it as Vilnius when describing it today." Squinting in the bright sun as I listened to my mother that morning, I had no idea what was beginning. I thought I had reached the pinnacle of our family journey, overcoming my fears of facing history, and then organizing my family to fly across the globe in search of a distant time and place. I could never have guessed that hearing my mother's story would mark a beginning, not an ending. It had taken a long time to get to that courtyard in Vilnius. Growing up in Southern California during the 1960s, the last thing I was interested in is exploring my European roots. What I wanted more than anything else was to be a regular American. My parents were from another realm, another planet, really. In their thick European accents, they told stories of their youth, filled with dark tales of war and genocide. As a child, it seemed to me that my parents had come from a vicious, ancient place filled with Nazis, concentration camps, and dead Jews. These were all things that I wanted desperately to escape from. Like many children of immigrants, I was determined to leave the world of my parents behind as I strode into my American future. I was actually quite successful in this endeavor. Backyard swimming parties and Little League baseball led to high school plays and senior proms. College led to medical school, which carried me into marriage, children, and work as a family physician. I was the immigrant's son who had fulfilled his parents' dream of what a better life in a new land should be. Yet over the years, flickering images of the past would intrude on my American paradise. These episodes began soon after I started to build my new family in Connecticut. One day in 1994, I was talking to my friend Vera Schwartz, a professor of history at Wesleyan University and a daughter of Holocaust survivors herself. We were discussing my reluctance to involve my young family in the local conservative Jewish congregation. I was worried they might reject my children and me because my wife Susan was not Jewish. Looking at me, Vera said softly, "You are wrong, Michael. Your avoidance has nothing to do with Susan. It is because of the Holocaust. Your soul understands what dangers the world represents to Jewish children." This statement left me dumbstruck. I had lived all my life in the United States, suffered virtually no anti-Semitism, and could not imagine that I was unconsciously paralyzed by my parents' history. Yet as I talked with Vera, tears streamed down my face. Given the force with which her words struck me, I knew there must be a large measure of truth in what she said. Then there was the family tree. After medical school, I had married Susan Possidente, an Italian-American woman of great beauty, talent, and insight. We had met at the University of Rochester, where I was a medical student and she was writing her master's thesis in psychiatric nursing. Susan is the granddaughter of Italian immigrants, with a vast family of aunts, uncles, and cousins. As we dated, I was introduced to her relatives at the annual Possidente 4th of July picnic, a large event steeped in family history. Every year since 1946, when all four of her uncles had returned home safely from World War II, Susan's family had gathered for a giant annual Independence Day picnic. There are usually over 130 relatives from four generations present. As a newcomer to these clamorous gatherings, I had considerable trouble figuring out which relative belonged to which branch of the family. To help me sort all of them out, I decided to catalog the Possidente family tree using a computer genealogy program. This process proved quite helpful, both to me and to other young men who had married into the family. Having completed my wife's genealogy tree, I decided to move on to my own family. Interviewing my parents, I gathered names, birth dates, places of birth, and stories of never-seen relatives who had populated Russia, Poland, and Lithuania. There was my paternal great-grandfather, Chon Gudud, a man of legendary strength who single-handedly picked up an entire tree that had fallen in the road after a group of Polish peasants had been unable to move it. There was my father's uncle Zelig, who had murdered his beautiful wife in a fit of jealousy when he caught her in an affair with another man. There was my mother's saintly aunt Emma, who ran an orphanage and who tragically cared for her only son as he slowly died from an incurable heart infection. Then there were the pictures, faces from long ago. A picture of Uncle Kasriel, Zelig's brother, showed a man who was the spitting image of my own father. A photo of my mother's Aunt Rachel confirmed her reputation as being a vivacious beauty. A whole cast of vibrant and boisterous characters came alive as I collected names and stories of our family tree. When I assembled the information collected from both the Italian and Jewish sides of our family to show to my children, I was forcibly struck by the contrasting pictures. My wife has 56 first cousins. I, on the other hand, have no cousins. The color portraits of the Possidente side of the family are filled with people who are alive today. My side of the family tree is filled with old, faded black and white pictures of people whom none of us have ever met. The good side comes to a sudden halt in 1941. With lives and families cut short, branch after branch showing lines that do not continue. Alongside my parents, one can see that there were once numerous relatives, almost 80 strong. But a close look at the dates of deaths reveals the same story. Almost everyone died between June 22, 1941, and July 13, 1944, in Nazi-occupied Poland. It was this memory of lives cut short, families murdered in the world's greatest crime, that I had been trying to escape from for the first 40 years of my life. As a child, my nightmares had always been the same. Gray men in Nazi uniforms with SS insignia coming to catch me, chasing me, trying to kill me. I did not want my children to suffer from such dreams. As a father, I could easily imagine the depression my relatives must have experienced in those final days as they tried to find ways to save their children. Thoughts and dreams such as these had caused me to avoid looking squarely at the Holocaust and my own family history. It was too painful. Reading books, watching films, or hearing stories about the war always caused me overwhelming pain and anxiety as I realized that mankind could not have changed fundamentally in 40 years. It could happen again. It could happen to my family, my children. When this topic came up, I always turned away. Better to concentrate on life here in the United States, where such thoughts and terrible images rarely intruded. Yet I could not ignore my heritage and history. Staring at my family tree, I could see that, even with so many lost, there were some that survived. What could we learn from the small tendrils of growth reaching down toward my children's generation? There were my two parents, William and Pearl Good, who had survived. They had three children, my older brother Leonard, my twin sister Anne, and myself. There is a small group of second cousins in Mexico from my mother's side of the family, and a similar group of distant cousins from my father's family who set roots in Argentina. Thus, in addition to the myriad of Pasadentes, Macrons, Lambertis, and Sebens from the Italian side of the family, there are small groups of Jews, Gududs, Gersteins, and Goods, all traveling toward the 21st century. I began to look more carefully at Holocaust survivors both from my family and from various friends' families. My father had survived the war after escaping execution by the Germans and hiding in the forests surrounding Vilna with the help of local peasant families. My mother, her parents, and her cousins from Mexico were all survivors of the HKP labor camp. They credit Major Plaga with saving their lives. My step-grandmother, Gita Gadud, whose husband and two children died in the Vilna ghetto, had been hidden by Catholic nuns after escaping the Germans. When I thought about our Holocaust survivor friends and their tales of survival, I found similar themes. In addition to their stories of terror, each also had survival stories that inevitably involved three elements: luck, tenacity, and an act of kindness during a crucial hour of need. As a result of these acts, they did not perish and went on to rebuild lives after the war. After examining many survivors' stories, I came to a new realization: that each Holocaust survivor represents a miracle of life, and that almost all survivors owe their lives in small or large part to someone else's kindness, bravery, or courage. Thus, for many survivors of the Holocaust and their descendants, an examination of the war does not necessarily lead only to the bloody horrors that mankind is capable of. It can also point to the ultimate triumph of good over evil. With this newfound perspective, I found myself gradually able to look at the past without averting my eyes. This exploration led me to plan a trip to Vilnius with my parents and family. It was on this journey that I came to stand in the HKP camp courtyard, listening to my mother retell her story. As I listened, a host of questions began to form in my mind. Who was this Major Plaga? How exactly had he saved his workers' lives? What had become of him after the war? Did his family know of his heroic acts during the war? Why did he, a staff officer of the Wehrmacht, German army, worked to save Jewish lives when his nation was committed to exterminating them? In trying to answer these questions, a new journey of exploration began, one that would lead from my home in Connecticut, through the internet, traveling from New York, Montreal, and California, to Hamburg, Frankfurt, and Darmstadt, Germany. This journey would eventually lead to answers about an amazing man who not only saved my mother's life, but the lives of more than 250 Jews during the Holocaust. On this journey, I would discover a man whose story exemplifies the choice that humans have to select good over evil. 1. Family Journey. Why would you want to take our children there? Look at your parents, look at you, look at all the scars you bear. Aren't two damaged generations enough? Susan Good, 1998. The summer of 1999 approached. In my medical practice, one partner a year can take a one-month summer sabbatical vacation, and the summer of 1999 was my first opportunity to take such a vacation. As it neared, I gradually decided that it was time to ask my parents and family to go to Vilnius to explore our roots. My father was immediately eager to go. My wife and mother, however, had reservations. After 17 years of observing me and my family, Susan had ample opportunity to discover some of the peculiar scars that we carry from the war. Once in 1982, shortly after we met, I was showing her around my parents' home in Southern California, where I grew up. As we were preparing her bed, I opened a trap door on the desktop, which led to a hidden closet, and took out the pillows she was to use that night. When she commented that this storage area was an interesting design feature, I replied that it was a good hiding place for us kids should we need to conceal ourselves from dangerous intruders. It was only then that it occurred to me that not all families prepare hiding places for themselves in their homes. Similarly, when having breakfast one day with my parents, my mother commented on one of our neighbors, saying that when she first met them, she was unsure whether she could trust them to hide us in case the Nazis ever came looking for Jews. She went on to explain that upon meeting someone in the neighborhood, the first thing she tried to judge was whether they would be friends or foes, in case of a dangerous turn of events. Being an insightful woman trained in psychiatric nursing, I'm sure Sue had seen many other examples of how the war left its mark on my parents, siblings, and me. For instance, she has seen how, when things start to go a little bit wrong, we have a tendency to feel that events can suddenly spin out of control and lead to disaster. I know that, compared to others, I have more of a tendency to feel that people who oppose me or who are attacking me are actually trying to destroy me. This is a fearful feeling that causes me to overreact to the usual conflicts encountered in normal life. Having made such observations of my family and me, Susan was understandably worried that a trip to Lithuania and Poland would immerse our two children, Jonathan, age 15, and Rebecca, age 12, in a suffocating flood of graphic Holocaust images that would harm them psychologically. While my parents are both from Vilna, and both are Holocaust survivors, their reactions to the prospect of going back to Vilna, now Vilnius, Lithuania, could not have been more different. My father immediately seized on the idea. "Yes, let's go," he exclaimed. My mother, on the other hand, said, "I have no desire to go there and see all those murderers." To understand my father's eagerness to take the trip and my mother's reluctance, it is important to understand their pre-war lives and their relationships with their non-Jewish neighbors. My father, William Z. Good, born Vovka Zevgudud, was from a small village called Niemensien, about 20 kilometers outside of Vilna. His father, Dovgudud, owned and ran a turpentine factory which was attached to the family home in the middle of the thick forest that surrounded Niemensien. Growing up in a rural community outside of Vilna, my father played with mostly Gentile peasant children from farms surrounding his home. Together they rode horses, kayaked in the river, and rode their bicycles down the dirt country roads. My grandmother, Hanna Kopelevich, was a strong-minded woman who my father describes as having been both artistic and charitable. She had broken the traditions set out by her Hasidic parents, and, rather than staying home to learn to cook, clean, and sew like other girls, had insisted on going to school to earn her high school diploma. She met Dovgudud soon after he was ordained as a rabbi, and he was quickly won over by this powerful and talented woman. After they were married, they moved to Niemensien. Hanna, whose father had been in the turpentine business, showed her husband the ropes in starting an enterprise and running a turpentine factory. My father recalls that she wrote poetry and tended to the ill throughout the community as a lay nurse. Because she was frequently at home alone with the children, Hanna insisted that my grandfather provide her with a handgun, which she learned to use. The locals all knew that Hanna Gudud was caring and charitable, but was also an armed woman not to be messed with. My father also had a younger brother, Motel, who was 3 years his junior. Motel had some physical handicaps, being blind in one eye and quite clumsy. He was a poor student and was kept back 3 grades in school. In the natural competition between siblings, he always lagged behind my father, who was both athletic and academically adept. However, in one area, he was unsurpassed: playing the violin. Motel, from an early age, showed intense interest and talent in the violin. Before long, he cared for nothing else and spent hours every day practicing the instrument. He auditioned with one of Vilna's most sought-after violin instructors and was accepted as a student. By age 13, he was playing with the Vilna Philharmonic. My paternal grandfather, Dovgudud, came from a family of fishermen and timbermen from the village of Griesdorf in Russia. After becoming orphaned at the age of 13, he was fed and educated as a charity case in several Jewish religious schools, called yeshivas, and eventually became a rabbi. Even though he was an ordained Orthodox rabbi, he chose to make his living working the land. Grandpa Gudud employed many locals in his turpentine factory and was well-liked by the area's populace, both Jews and Gentiles, because of his honesty and generosity. He was always on the lookout for local families who were in financial difficulty and would try to employ them at the turpentine factory or give them loans to help them through hard times. Everyone knew that he was scrupulously honest and would come to him to discuss confidential matters, looking for his advice. The Gudud home was a favorite stop for the local beggars, who knew they would never be turned away without a meal. While there was some underlying anti-Semitism in the attitudes of the locals, this was transcended by the good feelings toward the Gududs. Regardless of their attitudes to Jews in general, to their neighbors, the Gududs were different. They were good Jews. When he was 12, my father, his younger brother Motel, and their parents moved to Vilna so that he could attend the esteemed Tarbut Hebrew High School. Vilna was a great center of Jewish culture and learning, known as the Jerusalem of Lithuania before the war. During the 1930s, there were over 80,000 Jews living in Vilna, out of a total population of 200,000, and they played a large role in life throughout the city. In Vilna, one could find the whole spectrum of European Jewish society. There were the Jewish socialists, different sects of religious Jews such as the Hasids or followers of the Gaon of Vilna, a famous Jewish scholar. There was the group my father belonged to, the Zionists, who were dedicated to the rebirth of Palestine as a Jewish state. Finally, there were the more secular assimilated Jews, to whom my mother's family belonged. They followed a modern path of education and enlightenment. Vilna thus contained an amazing mix of Jewish politics, religion, and art. It was a vibrant center of Jewish life. When my father moved to Vilna, he immersed himself in the study of Hebrew as well as in secular studies. He and his classmates were passionate Zionists, speaking only Hebrew at school, eschewing Yiddish, which in their eyes was the language of oppression spoken by the Jews of the diaspora. The word diaspora comes from the Greek word meaning dispersion, and is referred to the dispersion of the Jewish people outside of Israel, especially after the destruction of the Second Temple in AD 70 by the Romans. He graduated from high school in June 1941, at the age of 17. Still, even after 5 years of living in Vilna and having been immersed in its exciting Jewish culture, his family retained its warm ties to
Sample complete. Ready to continue?